This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, American Chinatowns empty out as residents are lured back to the People's Republic. Also, why to be wary of campaign polls. And our series on mental illness in teens continues with cultural stigmas against modern medical treatments. But we begin with our ongoing 11 for 11 series of conversations with innovative thinkers on the big issues of our time. Today, Dr. Raymond Tallis attacks the notion of biological determinism. We've reported a number of developments on human hardwiring, from how our genetics affect shopping habits to predicting criminal activity based on brain scans. That's what made Dr. Tallis's argument so provocative. In a new book called Aping Mankind, he targets what he calls neurotrash, the explosion of pseudoscience that explains human behavior from believing in God to falling in love in purely biological terms. Tallis, a former clinical neuroscientist who devoted years to studying stroke and epilepsy, considers such claims to be evidence of Darwinitis and neuromania, which he finds ultimately pessimistic. We spoke with him from the BBC studios in London. Dr. Tallis, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Nice to be with you.
You're up against a few very big targets here, what you call Darwinization and neuromania. First, define those terms for us.
Neuromania is the belief that the mind is identical with the brain, as a result of which, if you want to understand us, we people, then you just peer into the brain with all sorts of clever technology. Darwinitis says not only does Darwinism explain the organism Homo sapiens, but it also explains what people are now. So you should say that most things we do relate to the desire to reproduce or to survive. And I disagree profoundly with the idea that if you really want to understand us, you can look sideways at, for example, chimpanzees and so on.
And both of these fall into a kind of what you call pessimistic biologism. You know, we are our brains. We can only be understood through our brains, that computer ticking off inside of us.
Indeed, that essentially we are organisms, and we're organisms like other inhabitants of the animal kingdom, and that if you want to understand human beings, you need to look at the biological script that we are fated to follow. And I don't believe that at all. I think human beings have actually escaped to some extent from biology, and we're writing our own script collectively. And it is almost routine now for people to say, I am my brain, or I am essentially the same as a beast. And if you want to explain why I behave badly, then look to the Darwinian imperative to support survival or whatever. And it is becoming increasingly common, not only in academe, but indeed in popular thought, to think about ourselves in evolutionary and neuroscientific terms.
You write in the book about, you know, this is metastasizing in labs. There's this sense of danger. What's the danger?
The danger is if we think we are beasts, then we'll think less of each other. And if we think less of each other, we'll treat each other worse. And if we think we're beasts and are, as it were, fated by our biological prescription, we'll give up on trying to improve the world in which we live. And that's fine if you're in a very comfortable position, as I am, but not so fine if you're in a very uncomfortable position, as many people in the world are. And one of my main targets is a political philosopher, John Gray, who thinks that every attempt to improve the lot of mankind is going to come unstuck, and that it'll all end in tears because we fail to recognize that we are animals and that we really are not in control of our fate. And I think that's great if you're a professor of philosophy, not so good if you're a child in the dust.
I must say that we on this program have done a number of stories on advances in neuroscience and connections between the emotions and brain activity, for example. Are we caught up in this, what you call the glamour of science? Why is everybody so swayed by these stories?
I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, first of all, all my research was in neuroscience and in stroke and epilepsy, so I know that of which I speak, if you see what I mean. And I'm aware that having a brain in good working order is a necessary condition of ordinary consciousness and everyday life. But it doesn't mean to say that we are a brain in good working order. And that's the first point. The second point is that we're having great difficulty in explaining in neurological terms even simple things like vision. Why on earth do we think we can explain more complex things like love, wisdom, or economic decision-making? And it seems to me at the moment people feel that by looking at brain scans you can understand the basis of all those much more complex psychosocial things. And I think it's not only premature, I think it's deeply misconceived.
So we read about love as actually neurons firing somewhere in the caudate nucleus or someplace in the brain, right?
In the cingulate gyrus, but bilaterally, you'll be glad to know. But it seems to me that you've got to look at what love is, and you've got to look at what the experiments that have investigated love are. Well, hang on a moment. Love isn't a response to a stimulus. It isn't even a state like being warm or cold. It's lots of things, and one would have to be a Martian not to recognize that love is about awe, guilt, jealousy, narrating the other person, being narrated by the other person, not being in love with that moment, and so on. So the concept of love that neuroscientists of love mobilize, it reduces it to the response to a stimulus. And if they'd read a book, or even a crayoning book, they would have realized that love is rather more complex. It's a many splendid and many miseried thing, which can't be captured in a response to a stimulus.
You mentioned a former clinical neuroscientist. You spent years studying stroke and epilepsy. And you've used fMRI, this brain imaging technology, yourself. So what did you come away with when you were studying those afflictions?
Well, fMRI is fantastic. It shows us precisely the nature of brain damage. It shows us the processes that take place when the brain is recovering from damage. And my own area of interest was in weakness, paralysis. And you can see what happens to the brain in the process of people recovering from paralysis and so on. But that's rather different from falling in love or being wise or making economic decisions. They relate much more to the community of minds in which we live, which can't be discovered by peering into the intracranial darkness where you find an isolated brain. What it means when I fall in love is not just what's happening in my left hemisphere, it's what's happening in the community of minds that is the human world. If we take very simple consciousness, like just being aware of a glass in front of me, some object, clearly there are events in the brain that correlate with my awareness of a particular object in front of me. It doesn't mean to say my awareness is identical with that neural activity. What it means is that neural activity is a necessary condition of my having awareness, but it isn't identical with awareness. So having a brain in good working order is an absolutely necessary condition of my being a human being in the normal sense of the word, but it doesn't mean to say that it is what it is to be a human being. And those who try to identify love and wisdom and economic decision-making with what happens in the brain are making the mistake of confusing necessary and sufficient conditions.
We're speaking with Ray Tallis. He's a former neuroscientist and has taken on some big philosophical and scientific topics in previous books like The Kingdom of Infinite Space and Enemies of Hope. We're talking about his new book called Aping Mankind. And he's combating two big ideas, what he calls neuromania, which is the idea that we are our brains, and that's really the extent of it. And also Darwinitis. Trace that distinction between Darwinism and Darwinitis for us.
Certainly. Darwinism, with which I completely concur, is a theory that explains how the organism Homo sapiens arose. But Darwinitis said this explains what people are now. To me, there's not only a great visible difference between life in the jungle and life in the office, but that difference actually is a profound difference. Most of the frameworks of ordinary everyday activity are completely unknown to animals. Just nipping out to the supermarket to buy a can of beans has 1,000 frames of reference that make sense of it that are simply unknown, even to our nearest so-called kin in the chimpanzees and so on.
From a scientific perspective, is there no value in understanding what happens when our bodies get distressed like that, especially in terms of treatment of stress-related diseases, for example?
Well, I think it's useful to know that when you're stressed, you raise your cortisol and that can impair your immune system and so on and so forth. But when it comes to treating stress, one of the ways is to, say, talk it through, to suggest you may have a job that is less stressful, to speak to your boss who is bullying you or whatever. All of those things are quite unlike animal behavior.
What, to your mind, Dr. Tallis, gets missed when we take that perspective?
The fact that we're explicit and conscious animals, that we do things deliberately for reasons that we largely know, that we do these things in the context of all sorts of frameworks that make sense of them. For example, I've come down to London today because I'm aware that I'm going to have the privilege of talking to your good self, and the reason I want to do this is because I would like to share my ideas and so on and so forth. And this is pretty normal human behaviour. It has got absolutely nothing to do with animal behaviour. And it's interesting to see why people don't observe what's in front of their noses, because you can see this and I can see this. So why do they not see it? I think people feel that if they set aside supernatural explanations of what it is to be a human being, then they have to have entirely naturalistic or biological explanations of what it is to be a human being. And I think one can set aside the first without necessarily embracing the second.
Well, you call it pessimistic biologism. Doesn't the idea of being biologically bound offer some hope for people, for instance, who suffer from mental illnesses, that they know that it is not a spiritual or moral failing on their part, but there is something with their brain that can be healed?
I think that's a really good point. It seems to me that when understanding mental illness, we have to see that it's got two facets. Clearly, there are differences in the brain in people who have schizophrenia. But that's not the end of the story. The person with schizophrenia very poignantly tries to make sense of what their brain is telling them. So the symptoms of schizophrenia are very personal. So to reduce schizophrenia to dysfunction of the brain doesn't do justice, if you like, to the heroism of a person with schizophrenia who is trying to make sense of the world despite what's happening. But the abnormality in the brain certainly is the underlying problem with schizophrenia. So you're quite right, the biological approach to mental disease is actually quite optimistic, so long as we don't reduce mental disease simply to its biological basis. And that's true on a broader front. We clearly have biological roots, we human beings. Most of the functions that I perform from day to day, whether it's, you know, eating or defecating or breathing and so on, clearly are biological. But that's not the end of the story. It's the beginning of the story. Biological dysfunction of the brain is the beginning of the story. And when one respects the individual who suffers from schizophrenia, it's acknowledging that they clearly have this problem, which has a biological origin, but they themselves heroically are trying to make sense of it.
Well, we're going to take a short break and come back with Ray Tallis, author of Aping Mankind, which takes aim at the assertion of biological destiny backed up by brain science and minimizing differences between humans and our animal kin, clawing our way up the evolutionary ladder. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome back to our 11 for 11 series of conversations with people who challenge and provoke ways of thinking about the most pressing issues of our time. Today, Dr. Raymond Tallis, whose new book, Aping Mankind, takes aim at pretty much the kind of scientific breakthroughs word of mouth often reports on. Now, we asked Jeff whether the emergence of reliable brain scan technology might rival DNA evidence in future trials. Here's what he said.
DNA is different. DNA isn't telling you what somebody thinks.
Does the brain scan of a psychotic person look different than that of someone who has a strong moral compass?
Take the psychopathy one.
A long-held understanding of how our brains actually store and then access memory. Tell us about direct access.
So the old model of memory was that the brain is a bit like a
hard drive. Example delivered by Professor Beatrice Luna. She teaches psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh and is a leader in the growing field of developmental neuroscience. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You'll find a link. Well, Ray Tallis is taking aim at what he calls a kind of neuromania, this assertion and a belief that biological destiny, backed up by brain science, is now guiding several different aspects of our life, not only in the sciences, but daily life and social policy. And as you say, Ray Tallis, in the humanities, what's your concern there?
I'm rather amazed that the humanities, in a sense, have collaborated with pseudosciences. And there are many humanities now that embrace the application of neuroscience to human life in a way that really seems to undermine their own ethos. Neuroaesthetics says that if you want to understand art, you should look what happens to the brain of people looking at bits of art. Neurolaw says if you want to make appropriate judgments in the court, then you should do brain scans on people who are accused of crimes. Neuroeconomics says if you want to understand why we make such unwise decisions, then we should look at the balance between the frontal lobe, which is prudent and tells us wait for it, and the amygdaloid body says I want it now, and so on and so forth. And it's rather surprising in a sense that the humanities have embraced neuroscience in this way, one of the founding concepts of the humanities was that individuals have a dignity, that they are conscious agents, not automatons in the grip of biological or indeed physical processes.
But don't these things, you know, musicology, maybe theology, have some sort of grounding in biology?
I don't think so. And I always find the neurological investigation of music extraordinarily barren. In fact, most research into what the music does to the brain fails to differentiate not only between J.S. Bach, for example, and Amy Winehouse. They both basically stimulate the dopaminergic pathways, apparently. But it fails to distinguish between the response to drugs or even sexual stimulus. And it seems to me that a science that cannot differentiate between hearing an organ played and having one's organs played with can't tell you much about either.
Well, a big concern for you is also that policymakers are embracing what you're calling neuromania. Paint a picture for us. What does that mean if played out to the nth degree?
Throw me into the briar patch. Yes, absolutely. Essentially, there's the idea that we shouldn't be thinking of politics of the right and the left anymore. We should be looking at politics of the right and the left hemisphere. That what we need is social policies that go with the grain of the brain, as it were. And I find that actually a matter of great concern. First of all, the fantasy that you could actually relate a social policy to definable activity in the brain. And secondly, that even if you could do that, it would be a good thing, as it were, to manipulate people through their brains to do what you consider to be the right thing. That the politician becomes a kind of neuro-shepherd to his neural flock. It's not only daft, but actually, if it was true, would be rather chilling.
I read a review of this book in The Guardian that said you are attempting to rescue atheism from the atheists. And I wonder, is there something inherently religious or even spiritual in your argument that there is something more than just biology that drives us?
I've been accused of lots of things. I've been accused of having a religious agenda, which I don't. I've been accused of being a creationist, which I'm most certainly not. I sign up to Darwinism. And I've been accused of being a dualist, that I believe that we are kind of ghosts in the machine of the body, and I don't believe in that at all. My feeling is I'm just inviting people to look at what's in front of their nose, which is the most difficult thing, just to see how different we are from animals, and indeed to celebrate that, and also to acknowledge that our future is not something that can be explained by a biological script. The future lies in our own hands to shape. Humankind has been something that has shaped its own destiny rather than being shaped, as it were, by the biological prescription. And it's just saying, remember you have freedom. Remember that collectively and individually we make choices. Don't pretend for a moment that we are fated by our Darwinian heritage. There is evidence that we've actually broken away from biology. Of course, as a doctor, I know we are still organisms. You know, every time I eat a meal, I know that I'm an organism that requires nutrition. There's more to it than just nutrition. Meals are highly symbolic. The food I eat has been brought together from all the four corners of the earth and so on and so forth. So I'm just reminding people about the extraordinary, miraculous truths of humanity.
Is biologism the enemy of hope, to quote the title of your former book?
I think it is, if you think we are fated to enact a biological script. And some writers have made that very clear. I mean, there's a very eloquent political philosopher, John Gray, who said that we delude ourselves when we think we are different from animals. We delude ourselves when we think we can control our fate in the way that animals never do. In fact, if anything, we're not any animals, but we're terrible animals. And I think there is a profound pessimism built into the biological reduction of human beings. Some biologists would deny that. The brilliant primatologist Franz de Waal says we've got biological reasons for being cheerful about ourselves. You know, some chimps are jolly nice. But actually, if you look at the animal kingdom overall, most animals are jolly rotten to each other. They don't seem to fret over each other's fate. If you're trying to find sources of good cheer in the claim that we are being understood biologically, you've got to be terribly pick and mix as to which beasts you choose to think we've inherited our propensities from. We take the biological givens and run with them to places that are not envisaged in biology at all.
Simon Shorvin of the UCL Institute of Neurology writes that all neuroscientists should read this book. Do you think you've changed any minds?
I haven't changed probably any current minds that are in the ascendant. but I'm vain enough to think that I might change the minds of those who are emerging in future. I've always thought my lottery ticket was in the 22nd century.
Dr. Tallis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Raymond Tallis, former doctor and professor, now full-time writer. His works include The Kingdom of Infinite Space, Enemies of Hope, and most recently, Aping Mankind, which we talked about today. To find more on the book and Dr. Tallis, and to hear more of our 11 for 11 series of conversations, visit wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for From Chinatown to Ghost Town, What's Behind Chinese-American Immigrants' Return to the Mainland, and Cultural Barriers to Treating Mental Illness. That's when Word of Mouth returns after the World News headlines. This is NHPR. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. We now continue the Out of the Shadows series with a look at how cultural stigmas can keep mentally ill youth from receiving modern medical treatments. WBEZ's Aurora Aguilar reports on why some families offer traditional methods instead.
For more than 20 years, Jerry Flores and his family have owned and operated La Botanica Emanuel in Little Village. This small corner shop sells religious candles and books on homeopathic medicine. And on any given day, you'll find a line of customers waiting for the services offered here.
Card readings, spiritual cleansings, sobadas de torceduras, meaning, you know, somebody threw out their arm, their knee.
Flores and his family are curanderos, or spiritualists who cure. Their talents for healing are passed on from generation to generation. Many Mexicans believe folk healing can fix everything from a broken heart to a broken psyche.
Basically, what we do here is try to help the people. We always put God first more than anything. Our number one recommendation usually is prayer, because praying always helps.
People come to La Botanica Emanuel asking for advice on important matters, or sometimes to get a little spiritual tune-up. Others have bigger issues. This is Leti Flores, Jerry's wife.
People come in with their kids. It's because the kids are aggressive and they don't know how to control them. They hear noises or feel someone with them, behind them. Some kids come with bruises and marks. You know, there are good spirits and bad spirits, so we recommend what to do.
What Leti Flores often recommends is a limpia, or a spiritual cleansing.
Es un carbón.
Flores lights musky incense and prays, asking for the customer's safety, health, and luck. She showers the customers with sweet scented oil infused with natural herbs. The prayer part and the curandero motioning like they are pulling out bad spirits from the body mimic the healing practices that take place in some Christian churches. The curandero's rituals, however, are very private. A parent whose child was participating in a limpia refused to be interviewed for the story, but she swears it lifted her child's aggression, symptoms that some experts might flag as a mood disorder.
Que le dé paz, amor y tranquilidad, pero sobre todo salud. Te lo pedimos por Dios Padre, Dios Hijo, y Dios Espíritu Santo. Amén. Lista.
Pretty much most ethnic groups in our country don't really want what we kind of offer.
Michael Kelly is a professor of social work at Loyola University in Chicago. In the 1990s, Kelly was working as a school social worker in Addison, Illinois. That's a suburb of Chicago well populated by Latinos, many poor. He often found it difficult to connect with them, but not just because he was a white guy from Oak Park.
I couldn't kind of use traditional psychological language to engage them. That wasn't interesting to them. It was sometimes a barrier because they thought they weren't sure what I was going to do to them. And I had to learn a lot about both the cultural frame they were coming from, but really also this piece of what are the spiritual dynamics, the traditions. Obviously, a lot of it was about Catholic traditions as well.
As a public employee, he says he couldn't ask about religious or spiritual beliefs when doing counseling. But he found that a lot of Latinos brought up the topic themselves.
They would kind of casually refer to how before we take this trip back home or before we put down money on this house, I'm going to go to the curandero, thinking I have no idea even what that is. You know, like, who's that? Cura what?
One of the children he worked with was Jose. He was hearing voices telling him to hurt people.
This was a kid that had taken a knife to his sister. In the medical model world, met the criteria for having psychotic symptoms.
Kelly found Jose met the criteria for schizophrenia and advised the mother to hospitalize him. She politely refused and said she would instead take him to a curandera. The mother believed a devil had taken over Jose. Kelly asked if he could meet with the curandera, and when he did, he brokered a deal. He asked the curandera to counsel the mother, but convinced her to take her son to be psychologically evaluated. The curandera obliged, and so did the mother. Jose eventually was placed on medication. Kelly had found a way in.
We're all walking around in eggshells talking to these parents and worrying that we're going to offend them. And here they go to this curandero who speaks their language, who directly talks to them about everything that they think is going on. They get more information, and they wind up telling these parents to do a lot of things.
More importantly, the curandera spoke to Jose's mom about her son's behavior in a way she could relate to. Many Mexican immigrants know little about mental illness or refuse to admit that it's even an ailment. Lack of Spanish language information on the topic and universal stigma against mental illness don't help. The curandera talked to the mom about nervios. This is anxiety or unease, like the less severe symptoms of mental illness.
They're kind of third rail words to not use. And those are often the very words that the white Anglo-Western medical model wants to use. Certainly some of the big ticket ones like bipolar or, you know, PTSD. I mean, like those things they see as very pejorative. If I could talk to a mother about her daughter having nervios, I could get some movement for her to look at a medical assessment, possibly a mental health screen. Assuming I could find somebody who was culturally competent to do it. Even when you get people to the water, they don't necessarily have any place to go drink.
Irma Hernandez is the program coordinator of the Hispanic Diagnostic and Family Support Program in Chicago.
Last year, we had a year and a half wait for a diagnostic. We're a state-funded program, and our budget cuts do not allow us to be able to hire any more staff.
She works at a clinic that caters specifically to diagnosing mental illness in Latinos in Chicago. There are only two of them, and that's unfortunate, considering undocumented residents worry about offering identification. And in addition to access, Hernandez says another huge barrier is deep-set cultural traditions.
A lot of these families have been living in either very rural towns or places where they don't have access to these formal agencies.
Hernandez says mental health professionals need to acknowledge that their patients' lives depend on open lines of communication.
You know, our role here is not to criticize and say, you know what, I totally know that back in our country, this is what they believe in. Especially when parents are desperate, as long as parents know that they're being respected and listened to, I think they don't have a problem with trying something else.
Latinos and Native Americans have the highest suicide-related fatalities of any young population in the country, according to the Center for Disease Control. Family and tradition is important in these cultures, and experts say that underscores the need to find creative ways to engage mentally ill patients in these communities. Aurora Aguilar, WBEZ.
Welcome back. We're talking this week about immigration on NHPR, and we turn now to reverse migration and other factors changing Chinatowns across America. The history and density of these storied enclaves reflect the ebbs and flows of national sentiment and policy on immigration. Most thrived in cities across the country after quotas on migrants were lifted by the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965. Well, today, these hubs of community for insiders and wonder for tourists are depopulating, and some predict even dying out. Many Chinese-American immigrants are returning to the mainland for the luster and opportunity offered by China's economic boom rather than chasing the dream in America. Bonnie Choi is reporter for The Atlantic, and she wrote about the end of Chinatown for the December issue. She's also author of American Chinatown, A People's History of Five Neighborhoods. Bonnie, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks, Virginia. Happy to be here.
Well, you write in the article about what are called sea turtles. What does that term mean?
Well, it kind of refers to generally the more educated, wealthier class of Chinese who were educated abroad. So they left China and went to prestigious universities, oftentimes in the United States, and then, you know, have been lured back to China for jobs and also to, you know, lend a a more educated and experienced heir to all of the businesses that they might start or the universities they might be a part of back in China.
Is it just the educated population returning to China?
You know, the term has been used mostly to refer to the educated classes, but of course now we talk about the more working class blue collar workers who are also going back, and that has not been a class of workers that people have been paying much attention to when they talk about the return to China lately.
So the effect is Chinatowns in the U.S. turning into kind of ghost towns. Do we have accurate numbers on these declines?
You know, we have. I mean, it's tough to track the data so soon after these that it's happening. But mm-hmm. what we know now through looking at the census, the latest census data, is that the drop in population in Manhattan's Chinatown in particular has been for the first time in recent memory. And it is chiefly the Chinese population, so that's very key. You know, it's not just that the population is dropping overall, it's that the Chinese population is leaving. And in San Francisco, so we're talking about large Chinatowns here in the U.S., and mm-hmm. in San Francisco, core areas have dropped as well. And so in tracing the trends, we're really going to see the numbers come up over the, you know, in the next 5 years that we would be able to see this. But looking at the preliminary information, it is showing that to be true, and particularly when looking overall at Chinese immigration to the U.S.
And not all immigrants are moving back to China. Some leave for...
Of course, right. That's right.
But is this just the American immigration pattern, Bonnie, of, you know, two generations and out to the suburbs? Are they just leaving the city centers?
You know, it's... I think this whole trend speaks very much to migration overall to and from the U.S. and, of course, in between countries all over the world. But a lot of people think about migration to the U.S. as a one-way street. And mm-hmm. this is something that is fascinating to look at when you look at it more closely, because historically, over 50% of the people who came here in the first half of the 20th century left. And in the second half, you know, that's what has slowed down the return migration, we call it, to, say, 25%. But when we talk about China today, we are seeing this happening more and more. And it's not just because of opportunities, economic opportunities in China, although this is definitely a huge factor, particularly as job opportunities wane here in the U.S. In recent years. And so it's a larger trend, actually. It's not just now. And I think that aspect of it is something that we should pay more attention to.
Is it government policy, Chinese government policy, to draw them back? Or, you know, is it just the lure of the Chinese dream and making money there?
You know, that's a great question. It has been part of the Chinese government policy now to, in recent years, to lure back these Chinese teachers that we're talking about, particularly because of the luster that an education abroad lends to, you know, people who come back to China, and they are seen as the ones who are going to lead China into, you know, more prosperity and to be leaders in all the different fields that they might have been gathering that knowledge here.
Give us a little on the history of Chinatowns rising in the U.S. I mean, you've written quite a bit about this. I mean, were people choosing to kind of settle into ethnic enclaves? Were other doors closed to them? What gave rise to these powerful and really storied Chinatowns?
Well, the traditional story behind Chinatowns in the U.S., of course, was one that was not very savory. I mean, it's racism, it's ghettoization, it's the Chinese coming to work here and being forced to live in these enclaves. And of course, in practice, it was a self-protective measure as well. I mean, the language and all of the different support networks that were available in Chinatown across the country became a haven, right? So they helped rather than just hindering. But of course, nobody wants to live in a forced ghetto. And over the last a century and a half of Chinese immigration, with certain laws being changed and quotas being lifted, people were freed to enjoy life and live where they wanted to live and work where they wanted to live. And certainly that has been part and parcel of the American dream. And now, certainly, Chinese Americans live everywhere. Chinese Americans are integrated into mainstream culture, and it is not, you know, the question of Chinatowns is not to say that every Chinese American is involved in Chinatowns, because that is not the case. But for the people who do come through Chinatowns and who do see it as a place, an entry point, and it's very true that these Chinatowns in major cities like San Francisco, New York, Los Angeles have been the major jumping off points for many, many Chinese immigrants to this country and persist today. And so that is just the starting point.
Well, Bonnie, thank you for bringing us at least that. There's much more to tell, and I want to thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Virginia.
Bonnie Tsui is author of American Chinatown, A People's History of Five Neighborhoods. She's also a reporter for The Atlantic, and you will find a link to her article on the end of Chinatown from the December issue. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also migrate to Facebook or to Twitter to join our online community of listeners. And before we go today, a check-in on campaign methodology. Over the weekend, Republican presidential candidates met for another debate, this time focusing on the sticky wickets of foreign policy and national security. CBS News, the sponsor of the event, conducted a poll showing Herman Cain sauntering into the debate as the current king of the hill.
John, Cain is still the front runner in our poll, but give us some insight. What can you say about his support?
Well, voters like Herman Cain, but the real question is, do they see him as president? One of the questions we asked is, who do you think's qualified to be commander-in-chief? Herman Cain came in a very distant third. That's a key question that will be at the center of the
CBS. Aside from the fact that a distant third place would still get you a bronze medal in the Olympics, we wondered how public opinion could put Cain in the lead, yet consider him less qualified to be president than two other candidates at the same time. David Moore, senior fellow at UNH's Carsey Institute and co-author of the Poll Skeptics Report blog, reminds voters not to be too easily swayed by swarms of polling data proliferating in election season. He says the same CBS poll that has Cain in the lead also shows that 80% of Republican primary voters have yet to commit to a candidate. David Moore is on the panel for Science Cafe New Hampshire, which will be held tomorrow night at the Barley House in Concord. We spoke to him about the subject of tomorrow's cafe conversation, the science of polling.
When we talk about the science of polling, what we're really referring to is the ability of small samples to represent a larger population. So that's the science of polling. Beyond that are questions that are asked of the people in the sample. That is more of an art than a science. And the reason I say it's more of an art than a science is that there are so many different ways of phrasing a question that we know that the way pollsters phrase questions can strongly influence the results. I think that most media pollsters try to come up with questions that are objective. They are not trying to shade the answers one way or another. I do think that most major media pollsters try to phrase the question in a way that persuades people to come up with an opinion, even if they don't have one. One of the major problems that we have with polls these days is the refusal rates, or the refusal of most people to participate. What we know is that if we have a sample of around 10,000 people whom we would like to interview, we're lucky if we can interview only 1,000 of them. That's only 10%. Polling assumes that you can get a representative sample, and it assumes that the response rate is very, very high. But in fact, the response rate is so low that it really does call into question the representative character of the sample.
David went on to say that the most objective polls can be fairly accurate, but if you'd like to see them hit even closer to the mark, you may have to stop screening calls around dinner time. The small number of people willing to talk to a pollster have great influence over the sample. And again, David Moore and Nashua Telegraph columnist Kevin Landrigan will be speaking about the science of polling at tomorrow's Science Cafe, New Hampshire. It's a casual and relaxed venue for discussing science that affects our lives. And you'll find a link for more on tomorrow night's event at wordofmouthradio.org. And thanks so much for spending some time with us today. You can listen to segments from today and every day at our website or as podcasts at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please do join us again tomorrow for Word of Mouth here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Virginia Prescott, Taylor Quimby, and Rebecca Lavoie. Oversight and support comes from Program Director Abby Goldstein and web support from Brady Carlson. We receive help from our online community of bloggers and contributors. Dan Colgan is our engineer. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. For more information about the show, to post a comment, or to listen to these interviews again and read our blog, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.